Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am going to be talking about Starling Forces. This is episode 253 of the Divine Intervention podcast. And in this podcast, I want to be talking about the topic on Starling Forces. This is one of those things that stylishly finds its way. I mean, you know, if you're taking step one, you're going to see questions on this stuff. That's a given. If you're taking step two CK, you're going to see questions on this stuff. That's a given. But I noticed that a lot of people trying to take step two CK, they really, really, really struggle with this topic. And the thing is, there are many clinical applications that your friends at the MBME could throw on exams to really see if you understand how these forces work. And to be honest with you, yeah, you know, it's technical, but it's actually not that challenging to understand. So my game plan today is to describe certain physiological scenarios, right? And then discuss them in the context of Starling forces so that if you're taking step one or step two CK or step three, you can easily answer these questions correctly. Again, it's just keeping your analysis simple, not being too complicated and not thinking in too many terms. And ultimately, you should be able to arrive at the right answer on these exams. Okay, so let's begin. So what if they give you a question about a person and they tell you that this person was recently started on enalapril, right? Because this person has been having hypertension. But then you notice that a few days to weeks after the patient is started on enalapril, their creatinine goes up like to a crazy higher number. Let's say it was like 1.2 before, but now it's like 3, right? You know, if you're taking an ACE inhibitor, your creatinine should bump up a little, right? But you shouldn't bump up that much. And I know some of you may be asking, okay, Divine, can you explain why should my creatinine bump up a little when I start on an ACE inhibitor? Well, if you think about it, ACE inhibitors, right? Literally, they're inhibitors of angiotensin-converting enzyme. That will prevent the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. The thing is, normally, angiotensin 2 is a potent constrictor of the efferent arterial, right? It's a potent constrictor of the efferent arterial. So if you're taking a constrictor of the efferent arterial out of circulation, you would then have dilation of the efferent arterial. And if you dilate the efferent arterial, right, that means blood will not hold, if you may, in the glomerular capillaries. Remember, we have the afferent arterial that leads to the glomerular capillaries, and then we form the efferent arterial, right? So if the efferent arterial is dilated, then blood will not pool in the glomerular capillaries. It will drain away, right? So the hydrostatic pressures, right? So again, that's one of the things that factors into the Starling forces. Your hydrostatic pressures will go down in the glomerular capillaries. And if those hydrostatic pressures go down, right, then that would not favor filtration. So the person's GFR will go down. And if your GFR goes down, then your creatinine should go up, right? So that's why the creatinine rises up a bit when a person is placed on an ACE inhibitor. That's one, right? So if they give you a question about a person, though, where their creatinine goes up just massively, right? Because again, if you start an ACE inhibitor on ARB, yeah, again, your creatinine should go up, but not like from 1.2 to like 3, right? That's an astronomical rise. Whenever you see stuff like that, the thing I want you to think about on an exam is that those people potentially have bilateral renal artery stenosis, right? So what's the physiology there? Again, basically, like, my job today is to introduce a physiologic scenario and then explain how that scenario is manipulated in the context of Starling forces, right? So the thing is, if a person has renal artery stenosis at baseline, again, remember, we have the afferent arterial leading to the glomerular capillaries, then leading to the efferent arterial, right? So if you have renal artery stenosis, you are clamping down on the afferent arterial. If you clamp down on the afferent arterial, then that means blood is not making its way to the glomerular capillaries. If blood is not making its way to the glomerular capillaries, right, the hydrostatic pressures at baseline in the glomerular capillaries are decreased. And again, if it's decreased, that does not favor filtration. But your body is smart. Your body is like, okay, well, my GFR is not really great. My creatinine is bumping up. Let me try to keep the GFR in a constant range, right? So what is the thing that happens? You have renal artery stenosis, right? your GG cells, they freak out because they're not seeing enough perfusion coming the way of the afferent arterial. So they freak out and they start making a ton of renin. If you make a lot of renin, right, that renin will then cause the conversion of angiotensinogen to angiotensin 1. And then angiotensin 1 will travel to the lungs, right, and the pulmonary capillaries, the endothelial cells that line the pulmonary capillaries express ACE. That will convert angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. And then that angiotensin 2 will then go ahead and constrict the efferent arterial. If you constrict the efferent arterial, right, you can already begin to see how that would at least raise the hydrostatic pressures, right, in the glomerular capillaries. And if you raise the hydrostatic pressures in the glomerular capillaries, that will favor filtration, right? Remember, hydrostatic pressure is like that pressure that is pushing on the walls of the glomerular capillary. So it's sending fluid out, right? It's sending fluid out, right? So if you're looking inside a vessel, hydrostatic pressures favor fluid going out of that vessel, fluid extravasating from that vessel. Oncotic pressures favor fluid staying within that vessel, staying inside that vessel, right? So again, these are all high yield things to know for exams, right? So the body is trying this compensatory mechanism of, you know, you have a ton of angiotensin 2 that will constrict the efferent arterial, and then that will raise hydrostatic pressures in the glomerular capillaries, so you have fluid extravasation, right? So you basically favor filtration, right? So that will help with your GFR, that will bring down your creatinine, right? So the body has put a compensatory mechanism in place to try to maintain GFR in a constant rate when a person has renal artery stenosis, right? But if you think about it, if you then start taking some kind of ACE inhibitor or some kind of ARB, something that blunts the effects of angiotensin 2, then you're essentially taking that compensatory mechanism out. If you take out the compensatory mechanism, the efferent arterial is dilated, right? So you are basically suffering a double whammy here, right? Again, remember, afferent arterial leads to the glomerular capillaries leads to the efferent arterial. Remember, basically, the kidneys have an arterial portal system, right? Remember, normally, a capillary is fed by an arterial but drained by a venule, right? But if you have a capillary fed by a particular kind of blood vessel and drained by the same kind of blood vessel, that constitutes a portal system. For example, if you're looking at the liver, right? Remember, we have those sinusoidal capillaries in the liver. They are fed by the portal vein. They are drained by the hepatic vein, right? So you have a capillary system that is fed by a vein and drained by a vein. That's a venous portal system, right? If you go to the hypothalamus, right, that hypophyseal portal system, again, it's also a system of capillaries that are fed by a vein and are drained by a vein, right? But we have an arterial portal system in the kidneys, right? Because if you look at the glomerular capillaries, they are fed by the afferent arterial and they are drained by the efferent arterial, right? So that's an arterial portal system. Usually you put a port, because some of you may be wondering, why do we need portal systems? We need portal systems because they help with, you set those things up whenever you need to, whenever you have an organ that participates in a lot of regulation of things, right? A portal system really helps you do a good job of that, right? So the thing here is, if a person has renal artery stenosis and you put them on an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, right? It's a double whammy because one, blood, because of the renal artery stenosis, blood is not flowing to the glomerular capillaries. That's a problem right off the bat, right? That already, again, tanks the hydrostatic pressures there, lowers the GFR, right? But then you then add to that problem by dilating the efferent arterioles, right? So that means whatever little blood is even in the glomerular capillaries is not going to be there again because it will drain off to the efferent arterial, right? That will, again, lower the hydrostatic pressure and that will raise the person's decrease the person's GFR and that will raise the creatinine. So this is specifically why ACE inhibitors and ARBs are contraindicated in people that have a history of bilateral renal artery stenosis. Again, that's a high yield fact to know, right? So now another application of the Starling forces is they may ask you the thing is, these things are not things that I think it's just more efficient for me to discuss these different scenarios because it will come up in some unique way in a question. It usually be some kind of arrow or some kind of question where they will give you like descriptions of physiological processes as the answers. And then you have to figure out exactly what's going on, right? So again, just really, like I promise you, this is just one of these podcasts that as you're listening to, you're like, man, this podcast really sounds benign. But this podcast actually has some pretty gnarly implications for your test score if you don't understand what's going on here. And also for clinical practice, this is like these Starlink forces are things that really, especially if you work in an ICU or you're an IM resident, it really helps with a lot of clinical decision making. So you may wonder, okay, why do ACE inhibitors help in slowing down the rate of diabetic nephropathy? Well, again, if you think about it, right, so let's talk about diabetic nephropathy. What happens in diabetic nephropathy? In diabetic nephropathy, the thing that happens is, one, the person has the non-enzymatic glycosylation preferentially of the efferent arterial, right? One easy thought I'll leave before you here is that non-enzymatic glycosylation of the efferent arterial is tantamount to or basically the same thing as constricting the efferent arterial. If you constrict the efferent arterial, what will happen to the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries? It will go up. If the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries go up, right, then that will increase GFR, right? And the thing is, you may be like, whoa, Divine, that's great. My GFR is up and awesome. Yes, that's great, right? But again, think back to this. There's nothing bad in working out, right? Let's say you go to the gym, you work out for like 2 hours a day, right? That's not a big deal, right? After a while, your body will take a breather. But I can tell you this, if you work out for 20 hours a day for a consistent period of time, the person will probably like die at some point, right? Because the thing is, your heart, yes, you know, your heart can raise cardiac output and everything for those periods that you're working out. But your heart reasonably does not expect to have to keep up with that demand for 20 hours every day for a sustained period of time. Really, if you really understand what I'm talking about here, I'm beginning to inch into the pathway phase behind high output heart failure, right? But because we're talking about starting forces, I'm going to kind of like hold myself back a little bit here. But basically, right, if you're glomerular capillaries are always like working, like they have like chronically elevated hydrostatic pressures, chronically elevated GFRs, over time that will injure those glomerular capillaries, right? That chronic intraglomerular hypertension will ultimately lead to something known as hyperfiltration injury, right? That will ultimately lead to hyperfiltration injury, right? And that's how people ultimately get into trouble with diabetic nephropathy. So this is why in those cases, the smart thing to do typically is to give an ACE inhibitor, right? Again, that will blunt the effects of angiotensin II. That will cause a dilation of the efferent arterial. That will lower the hydrostatic pressures of the glomerular capillaries. That will decrease the GFR, right? And again, the creatinine may bump up a little, but that will also decrease that intraglomerular hypertension, right? That will also decrease that intraglomerular hypertension. Now, another kidney-based scenario I think I should mention here, right, is if a person has BPH or any obstructive lesion that causes chronic hydronephrosis. Remember, on the outside of the glomerular capillaries, we have the Bowman space, right? We have the Bowman space. The thing is, if you have obstruction to flow out of the ureters, for example, right? That fluid will build up. So the hydrostatic pressures surrounding the glomerular capillaries will go up, right? Will go up. And again, if you have an increase in hydrostatic pressures surrounding the glomerular capillaries, that will push fluid into those glomerular capillaries. Those things are not favoring filtration. And if you're not favoring filtration, your creatinine will rise, right? Your creatinine will rise. In fact, let me tell you one trick here to know, oh, Divine, in what direction does hydrostatic pressure, blah, 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 do this or that? Let me just teach you one trick. Hydrostatic pressure always favors moving fluid to the other compartment opposite from it, right? So if you're in the glomerular capillaries, if you have an increase in hydrostatic pressures, it wants that fluid to go to the Bowman's capsule. If you have an increase in hydrostatic pressures in the Bowman's capsule, it wants to move that fluid to the glomerular capillaries, right? The rule is different for oncotic pressures. Oncotic pressure increases inside somewhere, wants to keep fluid in that place, right? Wants to keep fluid in that place. So think of oncotic pressure as I want to keep fluid with me, kind of Starling force pressure. And then think of hydrostatic pressure as, I want to move fluid to the next compartment, kind of Starling force pressure. If you think of things that way, you'll always be able to keep it straight. Okay, now what's another common scenario they love to put on exams? Another common scenario they love to put on exams involves a person that has, let's say a person is placed on a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So a person is placed on a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. So let's say something like amlodipine, for example, right? So something like amlodipine, for example, right? So if a person is on amlodipine, well, it's going to help with lowering their blood pressure, right? The reason it will help with lowering their blood pressure is amlodipine is a direct arterial vasodilator, right? It's a direct arterial vasodilator. So because it's an arteriolar vasodilator, the thing that it will do is, it will, because again, remember in our body, we have capillaries, right? And then from those are capillaries are fed by arterioles and drained by venules, you know, in our regular blood vessels, right? So we know that the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers like amlodipine, I'll use amlodipine as the stock dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? Those things are arteriolar dilators. If you dilate arterioles, right, that will send more fluid to the capillaries in the body, in those blood vessels. And if you send more fluid to the capillaries in those blood vessels, guess what? That will increase the hydrostatic pressure of fluid in those capillaries. And if you increase the hydrostatic pressure of fluid in those capillaries, that will cause extravasation of fluid to the surrounding interstitial. Guess what? That is the mechanism behind the peripheral edema that is observed in a person that is taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So the classic MBME question may be, oh, how can we treat the peripheral edema associated with a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? The way you do that is, if you think about it, if we know that, okay, you know what? A lot of fluid is pooling in these capillaries of the body, right? Because the arterioles are being dilated. Well, maybe we can try to get some of that fluid away. We can try to make those venules work better to move that fluid away, right? To conduct that fluid away from the capillaries, right? In a sense, you're basically trying to lower hydrostatic pressures, right? So if you think about it, you should be telling me that, Divine, there is some kind of drug class that can dilate post-capillary venules. What is that drug class? I hope you're telling me an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, right? I mean, this is almost like an illustration of the same concept in the kidney. If you notice, the thing that is almost like ACE inhibitors and ARBs, they are very good at dilating the things that come right after capillaries. For example, we said that in the kidneys, right? ACE inhibitors, ARBs, they are very good dilators of the efferent arterial that comes after the glomerular capillaries. If you take that same relationship to the body, right? Our regular venules, they come after our capillaries, right? So if you dilate those post-capillary venules, right? Then that will drain fluid from those capillaries. That will lower the hydrostatic pressures in those capillaries. That would decrease fluid extravasation, right? And that will treat the peripheral edema associated with taking a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. Now, another common scenario you may see with these styling forces on exams, right, is they may ask you about the mechanism behind like the hypoxia in a person that has like ARDS, right? Again, I suspect that the MBME will probably start throwing like COVID style questions on the test very soon, right? But don't forget that one of the primary mechanisms behind a person's lungs basically just going up in flames when a person has COVID is because they essentially have ARDS, right? They have increased vascular permeability. So ARDS, literally, right? You have like this nasty, nasty inflammatory cascade. You release all these inflammatory mediators like heparin and histamine and bradykinin, and those things will increase vascular permeability. If you have an increase in vascular permeability, guess what? That will cause more fluid, right, to drain into the interstitium of the lungs, right? If you have fluid in the interstitium of the lungs, that's going to cause a lot of problems with gas exchange, right? And the person will ultimately get into trouble, right? That is why the pulmonary edema in a person that has ARDS is a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. I'll say that again. It's a non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema. That's why the left atrial pressure, you know, but on exams, they may call it the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, or if they really want to mess with your head, they can call it the pulmonary artery occlusion pressure, right, will be less than 18 in a person that has ARDS. So they have pulmonary edema, right? But that pulmonary edema is because capillary permeability has been increased, right? Remember, one of the things that also happens in patients that are suffering burns, right, is that like the permeability of their capillaries to fluid also increases, right? Like almost like the filtration coefficient of like the blood vessels goes up, right? So those people tend to have a lot of leakage of fluid into the interstitium, right? Or if you think about a person that has heart failure, I mean, if a person has heart failure, especially if the left ventricle fails, right? If a person's left ventricle fails, right? Then fluid will back up in the left ventricle, back up in the left atrium, back up in the pulmonary veins, then back up in the pulmonary capillaries. as fluid backs up in the pulmonary capillaries, right, those people's the hydrostatic pressures in those pulmonary capillaries will go up. That will cause more fluid extravasation, right? So those people have pulmonary edema. But in that case, these people's pulmonary edema is from a cardiogenic cause, right? They have a cardiogenic cause of their pulmonary edema. If that's the case, then the left atrial pressure, again, which is also called the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, which again, you may almost also see referred to as the pulmonary artery occlusion pressure, right, will be increased because the left atrium is actually engorged with blood in a person that has a CHF, right? Person that has CHF. Or if you think of a person that has nephrotic syndrome, why do people have edema when they have nephrotic syndrome? Well, if you have nephrotic syndrome, you're pretty much peeing out protein, right? You're peeing out protein. If you pee out protein like albumin, remember, albumin is the primary protein that goes in the bloodstream. And albumin is one of the biggest contributors to oncotic pressure in the bloodstream. Remember, oncotic pressure's job is to keep fluid within that compartment, right? It's a keeping fluid within kind of pressure, right? So if a person has nephrotic syndrome, right, from like minimal chain disease, if it's a kid, or from if a person has HIV and it's FSGS, or if a person has colon cancer and it's membranous nephropathy, right? Or if a person has diabetes, right? And they have diabetic nephropathy, right? You pee out albumin, you're basically losing all the oncotic pressure in your bloodstream. If you lose oncotic pressure, then there's no incentive for fluids to be retained in the bloodstreams of those people. So that fluid will extravasate. And guess what? If that fluid extravasates, the thing that's going to happen is they will get edema. That's why people that have nephrotic syndrome, they have like edema everywhere, right? And if the edema gets really bad, they get to a state known as anasarca. Anasarca is almost like any like edema anarchy or something like that. Like it's like edema that is so bad that even other people that have edema will be like, man, your situation is pretty terrible here, right? And I mean, if you also think about it, any other thing, right, that causes a decreased oncotic pressure again, right? Like they can make a nephrotic syndrome question from this. They can make a end-stage liver disease question from this, right? Because again, most of the proteins in your body are produced in the liver. If you have no liver, you have no oncotic pressures, right? If a person has Ménétrier's disease, literally, I think, to be honest with you, I think of Ménétrier's disease as like nephrotic syndrome of the stomach, right? Sometimes on exams, if they want to mess with your head, they'll call it a protein-losing gastropathy, right? Basically, those people, for whatever bizarre reason, they're essentially like dumping protein into their stomach and then they poop it out, right? It's just kind of bizarre, right? So those things can all cause a decrease in oncotic pressure. If a person has protein malnutrition, right, from kwashiorkor, right? Like if a person has kwashiorkor, many people are used to seeing the pathology image of those kids having big bellies. Those big bellies do not arise out of thin air. If you're not consuming protein, then you would not have enough oncotic pressure in your mesenteric vessels. So fluid will extravasate from those mesenteric vessels and cause ascites, right? And those kids, that ascitic fluid, believe it or not, it can get infected. And if it gets infected, then those people can have spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, right? Hopefully you remember that for that you do a paracentesis, check for the more than 250 neutrophils, and give them a third generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone or cefotaxime. So I think those are kind of like the high yield Starling forces scenarios that I kind of wanted to hit today. So I'm really hoping you found this podcast to be helpful, but I promise you, if you're taking step one, step two CK, or step three, this is a podcast you really want to understand, because it's just a very nice way to see if you can manipulate different physiological parameters. It's a very nice way to see if you can manipulate different physiological parameters. So thank you for listening. Like I do at the end of every podcast, please subscribe to the YouTube channel. It's called Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. I also have a website, right, a WordPress website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. You know, subscribe to it. You get an email anytime I make a podcast. And then please also subscribe to the podcast, right? It's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Google Play, it's on Spotify. I've been doing these Step 2 CK courses for a while now. They've been very well received. So very soon, God willing, I should be having a step one course. Although the step one course will be broken into parts, there'll be like a section for physiology, there'll be a section for pathology, right? And then there'll potentially be a section for pharmacology, right? So it'll be like three iterations. The step one material is just so vast. It's not something you can really cover like in one 10-hour session or something like that. So I'll release more details on that, but I suspect that those courses will be starting in September. So if it's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to give you some more details on that. So My life lesson for today that I want to talk about real quick is talking about something that I call the Robin Hood generation, right? Something I call the Robin Hood generation, right? So again, this is more of like a financial discussion, but I suspect it will benefit a lot of people that are listening to this podcast, right? Because I feel like right now we live in a world where people that have no knowledge of investing are speculating, because now access to investing has been, has increased pretty significantly, right? So you see people, they just look at a stock ticker, or they hear like some hot tip from their barber or something like that, and then boom, they kind of throw in their money, right? I mean, like these things, I call them meme stocks. And again, I'm not going to, again, please don't take this as financial advice or anything like that. No, right? If you act on any advice I give you and you lose your money, it's your problem, not mine. But basically what I'm saying here is, and again, I'll try to be as general as possible, but a word is enough for the wise, basically is what I will say, right? There are all these meme stocks, right? Like you see some of these companies that are electric vehicle producing companies, right? And you see some of these companies, they don't have any products on the market. They have like no cars running, right? These companies have no earnings. But these companies, if you look at their market capitalization is like $15 billion or something like that, right? Or you see some of these things where if you do anything online, right? If they put .com in something, or you're e-anything, all of a sudden the price of that thing is bid up, right? I mean, like you see, like there's this company that does a lot of like video-to-video interaction that, lots and lots of people use these days. Again, it has helped a lot in this day we live in, right? But you shouldn't be selling for almost 2,000 times your earnings. But I feel like many of these like technical things that people are supposed to analyze when they're purchasing stocks, the current Robin Hood generation does not look at those things. They just see that, ooh, this stock has quadrupled in the last month. Ooh, I better join the boat. I'm telling you folks, I can predict that sometime in the very near future, it may be a month from now, 3 months from now, a year from now, whether you like it or not, one day this thing will crash. And a lot of people will lose their shirt in this market. So you see some people putting all their inheritance, putting all their stimulus checks, everything. They're just, let me just throw it into this stock. This stock will rise forever. It's just unfortunate that many of these people, they don't remember what happened in the 2000s with many of these dot-com stocks. Some stocks dropped like 99%, right? So just be prudent with those things as you're making like important life decisions. The key tenet of financial prudence is preservation of capital. But yeah, I guess I'll kind of leave it at that. But hopefully, again, a word is enough for the wise. You see med students these days, they're trading options, trading futures, doing all these things. I'm like, okay, you better make sure you know what you're doing, because again, you can lose your shirt. There are people, like there's a story I read recently of a trader, right? This trader lost like a ton of money, right? From like just trading, right? And then this person committed suicide, if I'm not mistaken, right? Again, just be prudent. Don't do things that you don't have much knowledge about. So thank you for listening to this podcast. I'll see you in episode 254. And until then, good night and God bless you.